Welcome to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Alex Cohen in for Larry Mantle today. Later on, we're going to be hearing about an amazing makeover that's been happening on Hollywood Boulevard as Quentin Tarantino films his ninth movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. They have meticulously recreated a stretch of 1969 Hollywood Boulevard in all of its grimy glory. That film won't be out for a while, but there are plenty of new films out this weekend. And here to talk about them, we've got a trio of critics, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and YouTube's What the Flick. Hey, Christy.
Hello.
Wade Major of Cinecods.com. Good to see you, Mr. Wade.
You too.
And we've got Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to begin today with Mission Impossible Fallout. This is number 6 in the Mission Impossible series. And of course, that means we're going to see Tom Cruise as intrepid spy Ethan Hunt, Henry Cavill, my other husband in a future life, Simon Pegg, and Michelle Monaghan also star. Chris McQuarrie is the writer-director. It's rated PG-13. Christy, what'd you think?
So all you need to know is that, as usual, Tom Cruise is doing his own stunts for the vast majority of this, right? He's going to die doing these one day, but it'll be super worth it.
Didn't he break his ankle?
Yes, something involving a helicopter.
It dramatically increased the cost of the film.
Well, but he also spent a year and a half learning how to fly that helicopter because he's Tom Cruise. So this does pick up a bit after where the fifth film dropped off. So you do have to have a bit of knowledge of it as far as why certain things matter. The plot is a big MacGuffin-filled nonsense about plutonium, something involving terrorists wanting to take over the planet. Plutonium, blah, blah, helicopter. And a lot of open-handed Tom Cruise running, as I am so fond of, because he has to run faster with the open hands. It makes him more aerodynamic. But again, the action sequences are so beautifully crafted. And what happens in a lot of big, dumb summer action movies is that you're disoriented. You don't know who is doing what, where, with whom, and why it matters. With these big set pieces, you are simultaneously immersed in the middle of them. You feel like you're in the midst of the action, and it's thrilling. But also, you have great perspective. You have great big picture perspective on who is where and all the moving parts and how many seconds are left on that ticking time bomb before, you know, can they snip the wires in time?
One to see in the theaters, it sounds like you're saying.
See it on the biggest screen you can find, not just on any screen, because a lot of this was intended to be viewed on the big giant IMAX or the FOMAX screen. I had the biggest, goofiest smile on my face for so much of this movie, and then I would just burst out laughing hysterically because it's so insane.
And because Tom Cruise was running with open hands.
Yes, it is the best. And the thing, it's really, really well made. I'm making it sound like it's dumb and empty, but these are so well crafted, and the cast is great. Ving Rhames. And then they'll give, you know, Angela Bassett a moment or two to come in and just be formidable. Rebecca Ferguson is great in this again, as she was in the previous one. Michelle Monaghan's character comes back, and a lot of her emotional through line has some gravitas to it. I love this movie, you guys. It's a blast.
Wade?
I cannot disagree. Honestly, Tom Cruise has been a part of my movie-going life for almost my entire life, it feels like. And I kind of figure he's older than I am, so as long as he looks good, there's no excuse for me.
And you actually ran to the studio open-handed.
He encourages
in his underwear
me,
with a broom.
He encourages me to not let myself go. You know what? Here's the thing about these movies. I credit Christopher McQuarrie enormously with this. Tom Cruise has found his filmmaking alter ego in Chris McQuarrie. This is McQuarrie's third Tom Cruise film as a director, his fifth as a writer. They speak the same language. They're the same person on either side of the camera. They have a shorthand, and everything that Tom Cruise needs to have a director and a writer do for him to make him look great, McQuarrie knows how to do. They just perfectly complement each other. And McQuarrie understands, as an Oscar-winning screenwriter of The Usual Suspects, this is not about how good the screenplay is. This story does not need to make sense. Nobody goes to a Mission Impossible film and says, you know, logically speaking, that never happens. You're there to see Tom Cruise do amazing stunts. You're there to see amazing set pieces. And they know this so intuitively that at a certain point, they just say, we're going to have fun with this. We're just going to sort of make fun of our own formula. And they take it right to the wall. And it is so much fun. And I just want, when the moment comes in the film where you need to start timing things, I would encourage people to have fun and see how they play with time.
You've both mentioned this time thing. Is it like a real-time thing that happens?
Well, there's a ticking clock in almost every one of these movies, but they play with it. When it slows up, when it slows down, when it speeds up, they play with it. I mean, it's like it is not – part of it is real-time. The other part of it stretches real-time beyond any conceivable logical moment.
I'm so curious.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yes, and you say that they're making fun of these kinds of movies, but they do it with absolute seriousness when it comes to the craft. Like, I want to mention real fast, the sound design in this is exquisite. There's a big motorcycle chase through the streets of Paris, and you are in it. You're hearing it like as he goes past cars and trucks. And
going the wrong way around the atoll.
Because he can.
I can't even imagine how many Parisian streets they had to foul up in order to get this thing shut, to have half the city shut down to be able to shoot that sequence. It's amazing.
Mission Impossible Fallout. It stars Tom Cruise, Henry Cavill, Simon Pegg, and Michelle Monaghan. Written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie. It is rated PG-13 in wide release. Next up, one I'm very excited about, the animated comedy Teen Titans Go! To the movies. It's based on the TV series co-created by Aaron Horvath and Michael Jelinek, who also co-wrote the screenplay. Horvath co-directs the film with Peter Michael, and it features the original cast of Teen Titans Go, along with voice acting from Kristen Bell, Nicolas Cage, and more. Charles Solomon, tell us about this movie.
I'm so back and forth on this movie. I feel like a teeter-totter. It is very meta, very silly. Robin wants a superhero movie of his own with lots of special effects, and there are songs about this, and some of the silliness works, and it's hilarious when he discovers that they're making Batman sequels not only with Batman, but about the Batmobile and Alfred and Batman's utility belt, and he feels left out when they spoof the opening of Lion King very cleverly. But if you're being this silly, you can keep that going for two 11-minute segments of a TV show. I think if you're going to keep it going for 90 minutes, you need a little more depth from the characters because it starts to feel one note and loud. There are no quiet, thoughtful moments in a Teen Titans movie. However, on the going back and forth again, the animation is very limited. A lot of it is just camera moves over still artwork and poses, obviously, from the storyboards. But this has aroused more excitement about any drawn movie since The Simpsons movie. Huh. And there's a lot of speculation within animation that if this opens strongly enough or does well enough, could this start to interest producers in going back to 2D and giving us something other than, you know, just over-rendered 3D CG films? So there's a lot riding on these rather skinny characters' backs.
That's a really interesting thought, especially because I'm sure there'd be huge financial implications for that. I'm sure a movie like Teen Titans Go is a lot cheaper to make than we should, since listeners can't see you're wearing the original Incredibles shirt, which opened not too long ago.
Yeah, I mean, this costs a fraction of a Pixar, a Disney, or a DreamWorks film. And then there's also the question, well, how much Teen Titans merchandise will this sell?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, a lot of questions.
And all the excitement about this, as you mentioned, like with The Simpsons movie, do you think it's because there's that huge television base that's a natural crossover for it?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
there are
lots and lots of kids who've been watching Teen Titans and are really excited to have them back. And this is bigger than you could make any TV show. So if you've been watching the TV series, you know, as with The Simpsons, we can do things we couldn't before. We didn't have time or the budget. In The Simpsons, they also got a little bit raunchier in a few places. So Teen Titans really doesn't do that, but it's like an enormous Teen Titans episode.
It is such a blast. And I have watched a lot of Teen Titans Go in my house because I've got an 8-year-old son. And a lot of the fun of this, I will acknowledge, was sitting with him next to me and just laughing our heads off together.
Yeah.
It is big and it is loud and it is silly, but there's this shocking subversive streak to it. I'm actually amazed that this movie got made in a lot of ways beyond just like, let's sell backpacks. It is so subversive in the way that it skewers the entire superhero, you know, monolithic empire, not just DC, not just Marvel, but both. And it's having its cake and eating it, too, because it is a big blockbuster superhero movie that is making fun of how trite and how pervasive all these movies are and the lack of originality that exists within these kinds of movies. And yet it is that movie too. And it's so genius the way that it walks that line. Kids will love the energy and the colors, but grown-ups will love. There are so many beautiful little details all throughout this movie. The songs are insanely catchy. So I think it's more than just like a silly, colorful movie to sell merchandise. And it's also not 90 minutes long. It's like 80. And it's probably perfectly fine just at 80. So,
also, by the way, Stan Lee gets a cameo in it, even though it's from a DC comic rather than a Marvel.
An animated,
it's the sort of thing Christie's talking about having the cake and eating it. He says, yeah, I know it's not a Marvel thing, but I like cameos.
I love it.
Kind of daring.
No. Teen Titans Go to the Movies, which is how I feel you have to say it. It's the film co-written by Aaron Horvath and Michael Jelinek, who co-created the TV series on which the film is based. It is rated in PG and it is in wide release. Up next, a film called Puzzle. It's a drama about an overlooked suburban housewife who discovers she has a penchant for doing jigsaw puzzles competitively. It stars Kelly MacDonald, Irfan Khan, and David Denman. Mark Turtletaub directs the screenplay co-written by Oren Moverman and Polly Mann. This is based on a 2009 Argentinian film that I don't even want to try.
I can.
You
I know.
You can, Christy. Okay.
Rompecabezas.
Nice.
It's how you say puzzle in Spanish.
Well, there you go.
Rompecabezas.
Rompecabezas. You learn something new.
Yes.
Yeah, headbreaker?
It literally means breaking heads.
Nice. Yes, cabezas. Very nice.
So this is a lovely movie and a really great, rare opportunity for Kelly MacDonald to just shine in a starring role. She plays this woman named Agnes, who is really conservative and really introverted, and for her entire life has done everything for everybody else, whether it's her late father or her mechanic husband or her grown sons or her close group of friends from church. She's never thinking about herself and her own needs. She doesn't even know what her own needs are. At a birthday party for her, where she has planned the whole thing and cleaned the whole thing up and baked her own birthday cake, she gets a gift of a 1,000-piece puzzle. She sits down at the table and does it in no time flat. And then breaks it up and does it all over again and finds that this is the thing that she's really good at. The challenge here is that making a movie about somebody who's introverted.
I was just thinking, please tell me they don't show the whole puzzle.
Well, the journey is the destination, Alex. But you see what the process of doing that does for her in terms of giving her a sense of self, and it also what would seem like an inherently introverted activity actually opens her up to the outside world, and it connects her with Irfan Khan's character, who is also a champion puzzle builder looking for a partner. And their chemistry is really lovely, and watching her blossom over the course of this film is really lovely. And the fact that there are no bad guys here is really lovely. Like, the husband's not horribly abusive and the kids aren't brats. Like, everyone's more complicated here than you might expect, and there are lots of lovely grace notes.
Wade, what were your thoughts?
Gosh, we're agreeing on everything. This was such a sweet film.
It's like
film.
You're building a puzzle together.
This is such a wonderful, sweet film. Directed by Mark Turtletaub, who's a veteran producer, was an Oscar nominee for Little Miss Sunshine. He's been producing movies forever. And here, late in life, is trying to reinvent himself as a director and has clearly learned from every director he's ever worked with, because he has a wonderful eye, a wonderful sense of timing. And he has a wonderful willingness, a wonderful restraint, a willingness to not intrude on the actors and the scene and the visuals, to over-edit, to over-direct. He really knows when to let go and to let the momentum of the story and the writing and the characterization sort of take its own momentum. And as a result, it feels so authentic and genuine. And it's one of those movies where you forget that people are acting. You feel the awkwardness and the exhilaration with a spontaneity that's really, really uncharacteristic.
Quick question on the plot. I feel like, is this all built up to some big competition?
Yeah, and it's one of those savant movies. There are a lot of these people who discover that they have an intelligence or an ability far beyond what they ever imagined, and they have to sort of come out of their insecurities and wrestle life.
I'm doing right now, it's my duty to get to that big skill of hitting our break. We were talking about Puzzle. It's the drama from the director, Mark Turtletaub. It stars Kelly MacDonald and Irfan Khan, as well as David Denman. It's rated R. You can see it at the Arclight in Hollywood and the Landmark Theater in West L.A. And speaking of the Arclight in Hollywood, one of many buildings that was transformed this week. We'll be hearing about that, too, up ahead. Don't go away. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Alex Cohen in today for Larry Mantle. We're talking about films with our critics, Christy Lemire, and we also have Wade Major and Charles Solomon. We're going to be turning now to a documentary. It's titled The Bleeding Edge, and it looks at the unforeseen consequences of advanced technology used in the medical field. This is an unrated film directed by Kirby Dick. Wade, apparently you thought this was the best movie of the week, and you've liked the other ones we've been talking about.
Yes,
so far.
I think this is an extraordinary documentary for a lot of reasons. Kirby Dick is a national treasure. He's one of a handful of documentarians who is able to make a film that is at once a great documentary, but that's also advocacy cinema, but which at the same time is balanced. And doesn't come off like he's propagandizing it and overlooking the other side. I mean, he has an opinion, but he's fair-minded about it. He's willing to sort of air all points of view and all positions from anyone willing to talk to him. Increasingly, people are unwilling to talk to him, though, is the problem, because when they see him coming, they know that he leaves no stone unturned and he can't be flipped. This is a huge subject to wrestle down, and it primarily centers on a loophole in the laws that allow makers of medical devices to claim grandfathering status. If there was a similar device at some point in time before they passed the law that says that you have to go through all these regulatory loopholes, well, then you get to bypass all of that. And so now 98% of medical devices get to claim some kind of a bypass so that they don't actually have to go through this extreme process of regulatory scrutiny. And the result is a lot of very dangerous stuff is getting out on the market that's destroying lives. And the stories that are detailed here are devastating, and they're as simple as a guy who's an actual surgeon who gets a hip replacement, and it winds up practically killing him. He has like a psychotic break at one point before he figures out what it is that's poisoning his body from the artificial hip. I mean, it's a very vast topic. It probably could have been broken down into three or four other documentaries, but as it is, it's meant to ignite concern over this loophole and to sort of create awareness.
Charles?
I'm not quite as high on the film as Wade is. I think it's a very important topic, but at least three-quarters of the film is about one device, the Esure, that was a pregnancy-blocking device that was not tested, that caused horrible problems for tens of thousands of women, and is still available in this country. The hip replacement and one other process kind of gets short shrift, and I think the film would be tighter if he had focused on the single device and the stories of these women and how they came together to protest, call attention to the problems, which has gotten the device banned in the EU and other places, and the obstacles they run up against in this country. The hip replacement is very interesting because he was essentially getting a kind of heavy metal poisoning from the cobalt in the steel in his joint. But that opens the film, and then it disappears for at least an hour until you come back to it. And I think if he had tightened the focus, a good film would have been a stronger one.
The film is a documentary. It's called The Bleeding Edge, and it's by Kirby Dick. Christy, you go briefly. We've got a lot to get through here.
I sat on the couch watching this, squirming and grunting and groaning and going, oh, my God, oh, my God. My husband was like, what are you watching? So this is a visceral experience. It is eye-opening. You think Big Pharma is scary? This is even scarier.
Mm-hmm. Next up, let's take a look at Hot Summer Nights. It's a drama from first-time writer and director Elijah Bynum. It stars Oscar nominee Timothy Chalamet, Micah Monroe, and Alex Rowe. It's rated R. Christy, what'd you think?
This is one of those movies about that summer that changed everything. And we know that because there's a narrator who tells us Daniel was never the same after that summer.
Let me guess, you did not like this film, Christy.
This is a movie that Timothy Chalamet made before Call Me By Your Name. Yeah. And so all these movies are coming out of the woodwork now. It is Scorsese light. It is trying to be about, you know, a kid going through this transformation where he's hooking up with dangerous people and how that changes him. Alex Rowe plays this drug dealer who's a bad boy who's also very sensitive. Micah Monroe is his sister who is damaged and in need of rescue. And Timothée Chalamet is our conduit to this world on Cape Cod and during one hot summer that everyone needed pot. And they are our drug dealers for this. It's got all of these Scorsese tricks with like zooms and whip pans and the use of 60s girl groups to punctuate certain moments. I was so angry watching this movie.
The soundtrack never ends. It is just wall to wall, song after song after song, which is kind of a stylistic cheat, you know.
Yeah.
The filmmakers will do that when they don't feel that the scene itself, in the writing or in the editing or in the acting, has anything to sort of get you going. So they slap a song on it to kind of create this artificial sense of style and momentum. It's very stylish. It's Goodfellas all over the place. It's Goodfellas with kids on Cape Cod in the '80s. But the problem with it is that there's no there. And this was a blacklist script some years ago, and you know, Elijah Bynum is very fortunate, gets to make his directing debut directing his own blacklist script. But the characters are dislikable. There's no discernible arc that anybody should root for or even be interested in. It's just kids basically flushing their lives down the toilet during a really wasted summer on Cape Cod. And as a vehicle for high style, I don't really see the point.
Our critics not so hot on Hot Summer Nights, the drama from first-time writer and director Elijah Bynum, Timothy Chalamet, Micah Monroe and Alex Rowe star, and you can see it now at the AMC Sunset in West Hollywood. It's rated R. We turn now to a documentary that's called Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood. This is about the life of Scotty Bowers, a Marine who served in World War II and after his return spent decades as a sexual procurer to the stars. It features interviews with Bowers himself, as well as Peter Bart, William Mann, and Stephen Fry. Matt Tiernow directed the film Charles Solomon. This sounds titillating to me.
You're in for a disappointment.
Oh,
you're
no!
Expecting that.
Who knew?
Yeah, I mean, Scotty claims that after he got out of the Marines late in World War II, he was the pimp to the stars. And it's not a surprise to learn that people like George Cukor and Charles Laughton and a few others were gay and were enjoying themselves with some of these people. There's no way to verify any of this. They do talk briefly to one or two very old men who are apparently on his staff. And beyond that, he's not terribly interesting. The stuff of him, he's now 95. He clearly was either Do This or be on one of the hoarder shows. He's got a couple of houses that are just overflowing with junk, a very put-upon wife. Understandably, if I were feeding skunks in the yard and bringing home toilets I saw people had put out on the street, I would not be terribly happy with my spouse. And since you can't libel the dead, he makes claims about people who Cary Grant always refuted any notion that he was gay or had had romances with other men. There's no debate over this. There's no questioning. His stories are just accepted at face value, and maybe they are true. I don't know. I just wasn't very interested in him.
I found Scotty to be a fascinating and flawed and complicated figure, really, really contradictory, because he's 95, brain seems sharp as a tack, but then, yeah, he's also a straight-up hoarder, and he is living in squalor, and his wife kind of only halfway jokes that she could have him brought up on elder abuse charges because it is so unsafe living in this crammed house up in the Hollywood Hills. There is stuff involving his childhood, in which he was probably sexually abused.
Oh, was.
Well, by
not even a problem.
By a multitude of priests.
Yeah.
But again, like so
and
many.
A neighbor.
Right. But there are so many stories here that, like, they make sense as a collective life, but they're also entirely unverifiable, and you don't know what's true and what's sensationalized. It's complicated.
And see, that's a bit of the problem with it. You know, Scotty Bowers wrote his big memoir a few years ago, Full Service, which is the double entendre because he ran a gas station that was also full service in the trailer in the back. And as much of a raconteur as he is, I didn't need a documentary that just gave me kind of a thumbnail sketch of his book. I needed to get behind him. The book tells me his point of view. I needed to have a different point of view. And Matt Tiernow is a very good documentarian. He made Citizen Jane and Valentino, The Last Emperor. He's made some very good docs. He just doesn't have a willing subject here who's willing to let him get under the skin. All of that stuff about his childhood, and especially the story about his brother, where he breaks down in tears over his brother. And his daughter. That stuff really, that's the meat. That's where I wanted to go. But he doesn't seem to want to let Tiernauer go there. I have one other issue with this, too, which is at one point one of his former hustlers says, Scotty was never a pimp. I worked for pimps. Scotty was never a pimp. And Scotty says, yeah, I never took payment. I took gifts, but I didn't take payment. I'm sorry, Scotty. You were a pimp. And these men were prostitutes. And if you were talking about Heidi Fleiss, the terminology would be entirely different. But we scandalize Heidi Fleiss and what she did and all of her clients, and somehow we're praising Scotty and the men that worked for him and the women that worked for him and the clients he had. And there's a double standard.
Oh, it's just locker room talk, Wade.
There's a double standard there that troubles me, and it may be a justifiable double standard, but I at least want that double standard addressed, and the film never addresses it.
Yeah, he's adored here by men and women alike.
The film opens with celebration of his life.
Birthday party, candle singing.
Four hunky guys bringing in a cake.
I mean, and this is all happening at the time of Me Too and Time's Up. Does that resonate at all, the current climate?
It feels like it comes from a totally different era. Feels like a time capsule.
And it feels like they forgive that era for it because it was a different era.
Yeah. Scotty and the History of Hollywood. It's a documentary from director Matt Tierenauer about Scotty Bowers, sexual procurer to the stars. The film was unrated and it's playing at the Arclight Hollywood. Next up is Dark Money. It's a documentary that follows local journalist John Adams in Great Falls, Montana, as he sets out to pull the curtain back on the real-life impact of Citizens United. Kimberly Reed is the director and co-wrote the film, along with J. Arthur Sternberg. Wade?
A very competent piece of advocacy cinema. It does try to be a little bit more balanced than these kinds of films typically are. I have two very large problems with it. The biggest one is that they conflate two very different things, and they never seem to be able to tell the difference. There's a difference between unlimited donations to a candidate and a completely mysterious entity that is out there making unlimited expenditures on their own agenda, where you can't trace who they are and where the money comes from. Those are two different things. Citizen United only really affected the first. Nothing about Citizen United has anything to do with how do we track down people that are out there making unlimited independent expenditures and not letting us know who they are. That's a whole different thing when you get a flyer in the mail and it has no return address on it. Those kinds of things. That's a problem, too, but nobody seems to address it. The other problem I have is everyone seems to dance on the head of this pin that we can't control campaign donations, therefore we can't control anything. And no one ever asks, why can't we control campaign expenditures? And that seems to me the corollary that never even gets touched on.
Christy?
This movie tries to get its arms around a lot and invent a lot of ideas that are not inherently cinematic. Kind of like a movie about making puzzles. This is a movie about documents. And it's a movie about, like, Federal Election Commission meetings. Like, there is a lot of C-SPAN footage in this movie. If you are a total policy wonk, maybe you will dig it because it does get into the nitty-gritty, but it is really complicated, and it's not the kind of movie that you want to watch while you're, like, folding laundry or doing other stuff in the background. You've got to focus on
this. They do have people arguing about court filings a little bit too much. That's true.
But you also have young Don McGahn as the head of the Federal Election Commission and always voting in the same block with two other Republicans over and over and over again. So, I mean, again, it's like you can feel the anger here. They're trying to make a point here. It's very powerful, but it kind of gets lost in the weeds.
Yeah.
We've been talking about Dark Money. It's a documentary following Montana journalist John Adams and his reporting on the effect of the Citizen United Supreme Court decision. Kimberly Reed co-wrote and directed the film, which is unrated. You can see it now at the New Art Theater in West LA. Just ahead, we're going to be talking about a film that's not out yet, but it has been shooting in Hollywood with Quentin Tarantino. And man, oh man, they have gone to great lengths to recreate 1969 right here in Los Angeles. That's coming up on Film Week. Stay with us.
This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Alex Cohen in for Larry Mantle. It's great to have you with us, whether you're listening to the live broadcast Friday at 11, the Saturday broadcast at noon, or on the Film Week podcast, which is available anytime wherever you get your podcasts. But if you get them from Hollywood and you've been there at all this week, you probably notice things look a little bit different, a bit more groovy. Director Quentin Tarantino has been shooting his ninth film. It's titled Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And his production crews have gone to tremendous lengths to recreate Tinseltown as it once looked back in 1969. That's when the film takes place. If you want to see what Hollywood Boulevard has looked like this week, we've got some great photographs and videos. You can see them at LAist.com. Film Week listeners, if you were here in Los Angeles back then, we'd love to hear what you remember about Hollywood Boulevard back in the day. You can give us a call at 866-893-5722. For more on this retro makeover, we go now to writer Chris Nichols with Los Angeles Magazine and Allison Martino, who's a contributing writer for Curbed LA, a columnist for Los Angeles Magazine, and creator of the website Vintage Los Angeles. It's great to have you both with us.
Hello.
Be here.
Chris, since folks may not immediately be able to go to LAist.com and see all of these groovy images, describe it for us. Set the scene of what it's been like there this week.
Well, for the last week, it sort of slowly grew, you know, as contemporary Hollywood disappeared under boxes containing the facade of the Pussycat Theater, you know, or great Googie coffee shop signs going up over the rusty mullet bar, you know, and the newsstands, the dead newsstands coming back to life with all the magazines of 1968. Just slowly, every storefront, back. And it's just been outrageous seeing it all come back to life.
And it's so realistic looking. I remember growing up and seeing the Pussycat Theater, and I can admit that as a kid, I thought it was actually a show that featured cats. And so I would say to my parents, when can we go to the Pussycat Theater? Which would, of course, been a completely inappropriate, because what was the Pussycat Theater, Chris Nichols?
Well, you know, it started out as kind of a high-class experience. You know, it had stanchions and red velvet, and it tried to bring this new type of cinema to the art house crowd, maybe, you know, but then...
But it was adult films.
It deteriorated into what it turned into.
Yeah. Allison Martino, I know you, like Chris, have been going down to the Boulevard a lot this past week, and not only have they recreated entire businesses, but they've also gone into like little details with, you know, advertisement on benches and flyers and posters. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the fun things you've seen.
For me, and I've been very emotional about it, seeing benches of TV shows I remember growing up with as a kid, local L.A. staples of Los Angeles.
The Rosie Greer Show.
Yes. Yeah. A park bench, and there's Boss Radio, KHJ bench. They're so realistic, and it felt like I was in some sort of dream. It felt like I was being transported back to my childhood. And that was very exciting and emotional, like Chris said. But, I mean, the detail is astonishing. Spare no expense. He wanted it to be perfected, and the newsstands and all the flyers in the windows, like of Peaches Records. To see vinyl hanging again, you know, cassettes for $1.50. I love seeing the ads for what ice cream cost, or a burger, or Coca-Cola, hey, pantyhose for 29 cents. it was almost educational to see what prices even were back then.
It was truly a different world. Film Week listeners, if you remember L.A. and Hollywood back in the late 60s, early 70s, we'd love to hear your memories. You can give us a call at 866-893-5722. You can also tweet them to us. I'm at KPCC Alex. We also have with us on the line Jeff Mantor, owner of Larry Edmonds Bookshop, which is an amazing vintage bookstore. It specializes in movie books and memorabilia. Jeff, for those who aren't familiar with this store, will you tell us a little bit about it and how it's been recreated this week?
Hi, thanks for having me. Yeah, Larry Edmonds Bookshop had started in 1938, actually, on Cahuenga, but in the mid-50s moved to the Hollywood Boulevard as a general bookstore, but realized soon thereafter the owners, one in particular, discovered that she would send out a catalog of film-related material to various universities and film clubs and places. And the response started to be overwhelming. They realized that there was kind of a niche here that most of the people in the rest of the country, or the world for that matter, couldn't have access to. And it was a lot more readily available here. And soon we became a specialty store. And we are celebrating our 80th year in business.
Congratulations. And meanwhile, you're kind of going back in time to the late 60s. How were things transformed to make this Quentin Tarantino movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Well, it really has been an amazing experience watching how the production design team has kind of gone back and found a lot of photos from the period, including some fun source material like the film Paul Mazursky's Alex in Wonderland, which features a wonderful scene of Jean Moreau and Donald Sutherland singing in the front foyer of my old bookstore. So basically what the team did was came to me and said, we'd like to put your bookstore, which I'm currently located at the 6644 Hollywood location, but my original, more famous location there was at 6658. And that is a more known spot. They said, we want to recreate what this store was in the original spot, which was next to the Pussycat. And I happily signed off and let them do that.
What was it like being there? I'm looking at an image right now, which I'll share with listeners. You could see at LAist.com, and there it is, the Pussycat Theater with its big oval sign above the marquee. And I think the films they were showing then, at least in Quentin Tarantino's version, is Babette and The Turn-On. And then there's your bookstore next door. Did it feel to you like you were transported back in time?
It truly did. I felt that... it's almost the slight, it's a movie, surreal movie version of our reality. So I think it's the best of what it could possibly be. And what it's really done and has been so amazing is generate just all this goodwill about Hollywood. And a lot of people saying something that I don't hear as much frequently anymore was, gee, let's all go to Hollywood. A lot of people wanted to come back and really go and visit some of their old memories, other people that have never had an opportunity, including myself, to know what Hollywood was like at this time. I'm a 30-year resident, and our store basically moved to the new location not too long after I was here, maybe a couple of years. So I never got to really spend the time in that spot. So for me, it's a really fun little opportunity to go and kind of visit my legacy and my history for a place that I'd never actually worked at or was at. It's really kind of I'm calling it kind of a once-in-a-lifetime vacation.
Oh, I like that. We're welcoming your calls at 866-893-5722, sharing your Hollywood memories back in the day. We've got a caller from Pasadena, Susie on the line, a Hollywood High alum, no less.
Yes, I am a Hollywood High alum. A graduate of 1965 is when I graduated. And I grew up in Laurel Canyon, so there really was no way to hang out in Laurel Canyon unless you hung out on Hollywood Boulevard after school. And that's what we did. On the corner of Hollywood and Highland, there used to be a drugstore named Lee Drugs that was owned by two brothers. They would provide summer jobs for us. I worked there during Christmas. I saw horror movies on Hollywood Boulevard as a young teen. I remember seeing Psycho and The Tingler. And basically, it was a place that you could go after school. You could sit at Lee Drugs and have a Coke at the counter. They actually had a counter there.
It was a gentler time, it sounds like. Susie, thank you so much. And we'd love to hear other memories. You can give us a call at 866-893-5722. Chris Nichols with Los Angeles Magazine. Can you kind of quickly for us, we're going to take a break in just a moment, but Hollywood then, Hollywood now. Two words to describe then and now.
Surprisingly similar. It's amazing how much of the stuff on the block kind of is there, architecturally speaking at least. It's all there. The preservation of Hollywood from an architectural standpoint is amazing.
We'll talk more about then and now on Hollywood Boulevard when we continue Film Week in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Alex Cohen in for Larry Mantle.
There's been a bad moon rising over Hollywood Boulevard this past week as filmmaker Quentin Tarantino has been recreating the Hollywood of long ago for his upcoming film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that stars Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. We'd love to hear your memories of Hollywood Boulevard back in the day. 866-893-5722 is the number to call. You can also tweet at us at KPCC, and I'm at KPCC Alex. We've been hearing from a number of guests, including Allison Martino, who runs the site Vintage Los Angeles. Allison, I always, for people who aren't familiar with Hollywood Boulevard, I say it's a little bit like Times Square, that, you know, nowadays it's where all the tourists go, but back in the day it was a little bit seedier, was it not?
Well, you know, I remember Hollywood before the Hollywood and Highland Mall, and I remember Hollywood before the subway. And it had a different element. I mean, I remember there were many more cinema shops on the boulevard, and I think a lot of it wasn't as touristy. It was more grittier and a bit grimier.
Yeah.
And after the subway and after the new Highland and Highland Mall, it's great to see Hollywood bustling. It's packed with people today, and it is very much like Times Square.
And one of the ways that Quentin Tarantino has tried to recreate it, he's restored businesses that have been long gone, like the Pussycat Theater that we heard about. But he's also kind of brought existing businesses like the restaurant Musso and Frank's, that Hollywood classic. He's put a mural on the side of the building. Allison, can you describe it for us and tell us what it's all about?
Actually, Chris Nichols is the one who noticed that for the first time.
Chris, you want to take that?
I was having lunch at Musso, and I walk out, and I just see these crazy psychedelic murals of Mae West and of Charlie Chaplin and W.C. Fields, and then put it online, and people figured out immediately that it was by this artist, Allison, is it Hanelock, Elaine Hanelock?
Mm-hmm.
And they were something that was available in, you know, in bookshops and stores in the 60s and were like a bedroom staple for people that were really into, you know, classic Hollywood and old movies. And they're like 10 feet tall. They're beautiful.
Hmm. All of this has been stirring up a whole lot of emotions. We've got a call in Sue from La Cunada, who was there in 1969. Tell us what it was like.
Well, I have two places that were really near and dear to my heart then. One is Magoo's Pizza Parlor. They had an old player piano with those rolls that you could put in, and they had silent movies. They also sometimes did sing-alongs, way fun. And then Pickwick Bookshop, and it was a multi-level store. I went on a first date there.
Oh, that's a classy date.
Yeah. It was a great date, yeah.
That was Sue from La Cunada. Thank you so much for sharing your Hollywood memories with us. As we mentioned, this film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is supposed to take place in 1969. But Chris Nichols, there have been a couple of liberties taken with the timeline, no?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it takes place on one day or if it takes place over a period of time because the magazines and the newsstand are from 1968, but the Pussycat Theater pulled their neon permits in March of 75. So it seems like a range. The bookstore, the Peaches, rather, record shop, opened in November of 74. So maybe it takes place over a long period of time.
And Peaches Record Store, for those who aren't familiar with it, or even records to begin with, because some kids today just don't know. Allison, what can you tell us about Peaches Record Store?
Well, I actually shopped at that one. So again, emotional seeing it and seeing all the records. They used to have tape record slats that you put all your tapes in. They were sort of known for that. And to see that in the shops and to see the posters and to see the records for $1.99. I miss record stores. Of course, we love Amoeba and Last Record Store, Record Surplus, but they just aren't around as much as they were. And that great art and the Peaches records, they were known for their T-shirts. They were a great marketing record store in the beginning. And I don't know if he's using creative license and he's just setting a tone for Hollywood Boulevard and bringing back some of his beloved places. I know he's really supportive and he's nostalgic about that. But he also worked at a Pussycat Theater the day. So I'm wondering if that's his tribute.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
People have also been very excited to see a neon sign for the Supply Sergeant. Chris, can you describe this one for us?
Well, it's enormous. It's on the roof. It's a soldier with a bayonet, and it's got this great flashing arrow that circles around it. It's been dark for a while, and then, you know, I'm over at Musso's, and I see their sign is beautifully restored, perfect. The supply sergeants go, and the little Michelli sign on the corner of Las Palmas and Hollywood is blinking. It's the energy, and maybe it is a pastiche, and it's just the energy of the neon and the flashing and the people and the storefronts and the loudness of it all that he really captured and brought back.
Jeff Mentor is the owner of Larry Edmonds Bookshop, which has been recreated for this film as well. There's been a whole lot of action with the filming there, but of course Hollywood is still a place that lots of tourists go to. I'm curious, Jeff, what it's been like for people. I would imagine it'd be very bizarre. You come to LA thinking you're going to go to Hollywood and see movie stars or things of that nature, and then it looks way groovier than you ever thought it would be. What have you been hearing?
Well, if you were here this week, you actually did get to see that, and that dream actually came true.
Yeah.
You could have spotted Leonardo DiCaprio or Brad Pitt or Al Pacino, all on the neighborhood, and I think a lot of people think that's a little more common than it actually is. But this week, those dreams did come true, as well as all the wonderful sets. I can also comment firsthand that I know the subject of creative license and to whether or not he took, you know, historical movie liberties with some of the sets. It was a conscious decision to choose a couple of the places that were chosen, and they were chosen based on, you know, I think memories. And I mean, I know I was told personally that my store was a place that the director frequented from the time he was 15 years old.
Wow.
So that was something, and I believe a couple of the other places recreated, such as Peaches, were done, you know, with a specific memory in mind, as well as probably the aesthetic possibilities of something like the Pussycat, which is, I mean, the set was just magical looking. So I think it's going to really, really look brilliant when we all get to kind of, you know, take that walk back. And some of the pictures that I've seen that they used may have not been from the 69 period, but they absolutely recreated them, you know, to a T.
And Jeff, you alluded there that you heard from the director personally. Is it safe to expect that maybe we will see you in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood when it comes out?
I wish that were the case, but it will not. You will get to see my wonderful signage and my wonderful store and a wonderful memory of that. But I will not be seen. I believe there may be a cameo by the director himself, and there are a few pictures to that nature out and about that people caught him doing what will be his maybe his Hitchcock moment.
We would only expect as much from the filmmaker Quentin Tarantino. He's been shooting all this week right here in Hollywood, where he has done a pretty spectacular job of recreating businesses that have not been around for a long time and sprucing up some that still exist, like Musso and Frank's. You can see images and a video at LAist.com. My thanks to guest Chris Nichols of LA Magazine, Jeff Mentor, owner of Larry Edmonds Bookshop, and Allison Martino of Vintage Los Angeles. You've been listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Alex Cohen in for Larry Mantle. We leave you today with Tommy James and the Shondells and their hit Crystal Blue Persuasion, which ended 1969 at number 12 on the Billboard Top 100. A reminder, you can hear Film Week every Friday live at 11, Saturday at noon, and anytime on the Film Week podcast.